Sounds True and Shambhala Lion Editions present A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Session 3, The Evolution of Consciousness.
So this is where we begin to touch on those eternal spiritual themes of the good, the true, and the beautiful found in all traditions. You've tied what you call the big three to the notions of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha being a great spiritual realizer, the representation of ultimate beauty. Dharma as the ultimate truth that he realized, or simply the true. And Sangha as the community of those who are attempting this realization, what's referred to as the good.
Mm-hmm, yes, those are the big three. As consciousness evolution continues into the higher or superconscious or transpersonal domains. Of course, this is using the Buddhist terms. Others will do as well. My point is that deeper developments also proceed in all four quadrants, or in simplified form, in the big three. This higher evolution occurs in the I, and the we, and the it domains. And the ultimate I is Buddha, the ultimate we is Sangha, and the ultimate it is Dharma.
For example?
Well, we can put this in several different ways. When you are ultimately truthful with yourself, you will eventually realize and confess that I am Buddha, I am spirit. Anything short of that is a lie, the lie of the ego, the lie of the separate self-sense, the contraction in the face of infinity. The deepest recesses of your consciousness directly intersect spirit itself in the supreme identity. Not I, but Christ liveth in me, which is to say, the ultimate I is Christ. This isn't a state you're bringing into existence for the first time, but simply a timeless state that you're recognizing and confessing. You are being ultimately truthful when you state, I am Buddha, the ultimate beauty. And the ultimate cultural fit or justness is, we are all members of the community of spirit. All sentient beings, all holons, in fact, contain Buddha nature, contain depth, consciousness, intrinsic value, spirit. And thus, we are all members of the council of all beings, the mystical church, the ultimate we, which is ultimate ethics, the ultimate good. And the ultimate objective truth is that all beings are perfect manifestations of spirit or emptiness. We are all manifestations of the ultimate it, or Dharma, which is the ultimate truth. The ultimate I, the ultimate we, and the ultimate it, Buddha, Sangha, Dharma.
So this is why you say that understanding the four quadrants, or simply the big three, is so important for understanding higher spiritual developments. This is why you say we need an all-level, all-quadrant approach?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yes. Spirit manifests in all four quadrants equally, and so all four quadrants, or simply the big three, ought to be taken into account in order for the realization of spirit to be full and complete and unbroken.
So Buddha, or the ultimate beauty?
Well, we haven't talked about these higher stages of the upper left quadrant. But the essential point is that they disclose deeper or higher stages of consciousness, to the point that the individual I discovers its prior identity with spirit, however you wish to conceive that. The Buddhists would say that the individual I discovers its prior nature as emptiness, so that the isolated and alienated I relaxes into the radically open and empty transparent ground of all manifestation. The Sufis call it the supreme identity, the identity of the soul and Godhead. In Zen, we have the true self that is no self, or no individual self at all, this primordial emptiness that is the transparency of all form. In Christianity, let this consciousness be in you which was in Christ Jesus. The evidence is simply that the individual self discovers a primordial and unqualifiable ground, so that its own self intersects the ground of the cosmos at large. The ultimate self, that is, no self, that is, the Buddha nature or Buddha mind or Christ consciousness in each and every sentient being. The ultimate self, the ultimate I, is Buddha, that's upper left.
And Dharma, or the true?
Well, Dharma refers to spirit as an objective fact, as an objective state of affairs. The ultimate it of the cosmos is the Dharma, the truth, the objective isness or suchness or thusness of all holons. The very condition of all conditions, the very nature of all natures, the very itness of all holons. This is the Dharma, the objective truth, which is that all holons, just as they are in their itness, are perfect manifestations of emptiness, of spirit. And that is the ultimate truth.
Okay, so I can see how when you're talking about the ultimate truth, you're referring to both the upper right and lower right quadrants, covering both the individual and social context. Now, what about Sangha?
Well, Sangha means gathering or community. It is the we of spirit. In mystical Christian terms, it's the church, the mystical communion of Christ. It's the intersubjective circle of realization, the culture of the divine, the lower left. The point is that precisely because spirit manifests equally in all four quadrants, or equally in the big three, then we can describe spirit subjectively as one's own Buddha mind, the eye of spirit, the beauty. And we can describe spirit objectively as Dharma, the it of spirit, the ultimate truth. And we can describe spirit culturally as Sangha, the we of spirit, the ultimate good. These four quadrants, or the big three, are all facets of spirit, facets of emptiness. When emptiness manifests, it does so as subject and object, each of which can be singular or plural. And that gives us the four quadrants, or simply the big three. So spirit can be described, and must be described, with all three languages, I and we and it. Each of those domains evolves, which means each unfolds its spiritual nature more and more, and thus realizes its spiritual nature more and more. And in the uppermost reaches of that evolution, the I and the we and the it increasingly become transparent to their own true nature. They each radiate the glory of the ground that they are. And in that radiant awareness, every I becomes a god, and every we becomes God's sincerest worship, and every it becomes God's most gracious temple.
So you explain that an integral approach is both all quadrant and all level. We've looked at all the quadrants. Now I'd like to look at the all level component. I want to discuss the evolution of consciousness itself from the lowest to the highest stages, going from matter to body to mind to soul to spirit. Can you explain what you mean by an all level approach and how it fits with the quadrants?
Well, let me first emphasize that we're now discussing just the upper left quadrant, the interior stages of consciousness evolution. So we're not discussing, for example, the correlative changes in the upper right quadrant. We aren't discussing changes in the brainstem, the limbic system, the neocortex, and so on. Likewise, we aren't looking specifically at the larger cultural currents, lower left, or social structures, lower right, that are inseparable from individual consciousness development, even though these other quadrants are crucially important. What good does it do to adjust and integrate the self in a culture that is itself sick? What does it mean to be a well-adjusted Nazi? Is that mental health? Or is a maladjusted person in a Nazi society the only one who's sane? All of those are crucial considerations. A malformation, a pathology, a sickness in any quadrant will reverberate through all four quadrants because every holon has these four facets to its being. So a society with an alienating mode of production, lower right quadrant, such as slave wages for dehumanizing labor, will reflect in low self-esteem for laborers, that's the upper left quadrant, and an out-of-whack brain chemistry, the upper right quadrant, that might, for example, institutionalize alcohol abuse as self-medication. Similarly, a cultural worldview that devalues women will result in a tendency to cripple individual female potential. And so it goes around the four-quadrant circle. Cripple one quadrant, and all four tend to hemorrhage. But in this discussion, we'll temporarily ignore all that. Ignore family therapy, ignore brain chemistry and brain states, ignore cultural and social analysis, so we can focus on the upper left quadrant itself and discuss the levels of consciousness as they appear in an individual. But don't imagine those other quadrants are unimportant. In fact, we're fast approaching an understanding that sees individual pathologies as but the tip of an enormous iceberg that includes world views, social structures, and cultural access to depth. Individual therapy is not unimportant, but in many ways it's almost secondary. But for now, yes, we can definitely focus on the upper left quadrant. Every society has a certain center of gravity, we might say, around which the culture's ethics, norms, rules, and basic institutions are organized. And this center of gravity provides the basic cultural cohesion and social integration for that society. This cultural center of gravity acts like a magnet on individual development. If you're below the average level, it tends to pull you up. If you try to go above it, it tends to pull you down. The cultural center of gravity acts as a pacer of development, a magnet, pulling you up to the average expectable level of consciousness development. Beyond that, you're on your own, and lots of luck. Because now the magnet will try to drag you down. In both cases, you're outlawed.
So you're saying that there's a difference between the average mode and the most advanced mode of consciousness for any culture?
Oh, yes, absolutely, that's right. For example, say that 500 years from now, an anthropologist is studying America and comes across the writings of Krishnamurti and decides everybody in America was like Krishnamurti. Well, this is silly, of course, but that's what many theorists are doing with past epochs. They take a representative of the most advanced mode of consciousness at the time, say a shaman, and conclude that the average mode was also shamanic, that 100,000 years ago everybody was a shaman. So one of the things I've tried to do in looking at these past epochs is, first, to define the average center of gravity, and second, to look carefully at the most evolved individuals who rose above this average mode, often at great cost to themselves, and disclosed higher or deeper modes of awareness, for example, the shaman, the yogi, the saint, the sage.
Are all of these stages really as ladder-like as you present them to be? Are they really that discrete?
Well, many people think that developmental models are rigidly linear, but this is a misunderstanding of what developmental models attempt to do. The best way to think of development is as a series of concentric circles or nested spheres, with each higher level transcending and including its predecessor. It is an actualization holarchy, each stage of which unfolds and then enfolds its predecessors in a nested fashion. But more important, these nine levels or spheres only deal with a part of what is actually going on with consciousness development. There's still the climber of the ladder, and there are the different views from each rung, none of which is a simple linear step-by-step process.
Okay, so we've got the ladder, the climber, and the view. Let's start with the ladder, the levels or spheres of development.
Well, these nine levels or spheres are the basic levels of consciousness.
Since these are actually nested spheres of development, why do you refer to them as a ladder?
The ladder metaphor is useful because it indicates that the basic components of consciousness do emerge in fairly discrete stages, and if you destroy a lower rung, all the higher rungs go with it. Where the latter metaphor fails badly is that each higher stage does not actually sit on top of the lower stage, but rather enfolds it in its own being, much as a cell enfolds molecules which enfold atoms. As I said, it's a nested holarchy. But I myself often use the latter metaphor because I want especially to emphasize the levels of growth involved. For example, in development, images emerge before symbols, which emerge before concepts, which emerge before rules, and so on. This order is irreversible. No amount of social conditioning can alter that sequence, and we know of no societies where that order is altered. It is holarchical, it is cross-cultural, and as far as we can tell, there are no exceptions. Just as you must have words before you can have sentences, and you must have sentences before you can have paragraphs, so these basic holons build upon and incorporate their predecessors, which is why the order cannot be reversed. The higher rungs rest on the lower, and that's part of the usefulness of the ladder metaphor.
Okay, so those are the basic rungs of the ladder of awareness, if you will, or the holarchy of awareness.
Yes, that's right. But that is not where the real action is, so to speak. Even if we rather crudely picture this development of basic levels as a ladder, the real action involves the climber of the ladder. This climber is the self, sometimes called the self system.
So does this self or self system have its own characteristics?
Well, yes, the self, the climber, has specific characteristics and capacities that are not found on the ladder itself. The reason is that the ladder is basically selfless. There is no inherent self-sense in any of its rungs. But the self appropriates these rungs or identifies with them, and this generates various types of self-identity and various stages of self-growth until the self falls off the ladder altogether in radical emptiness, which is a bit ahead of the story. But the point is that the ladder and the climber of the ladder are quite different affairs. It's not necessary to go into those, but I might mention that navigation, for example, involves the four drives that all holons, including the self-holon, possess, namely agency and communion, self-transcendence, and self-dissolution, or regression. At each rung in the self's growth and development, it has these four basic choices about which way to go in its own development. Too much or too little of any of those four drives, and the self gets into pathological trouble, and the types of pathology depend on which of the nine basic rungs the trouble occurs at.
So as the self negotiates or climbs these basic rungs, traverses these nested spheres, things can go wrong at any rung or stage?
Oh yes, the self might be climbing the ladder of expanding consciousness, but the crucial point is that it can lose an arm or a leg at any rung. If something goes wrong at any stage in this developmental unfolding, aspects of the self can get damaged or left behind. This getting left behind is called repression or dissociation or alienation. The self can lose an arm or a leg at any stage, and this loss results in a pathology that is characteristic of the stage at which the loss occurred. So we see pathology go from psychosis to borderline to neurosis to existential to spiritual, depending upon where the accident occurred. I'll give you some concrete examples of this in just a moment. The point for now is that not only are these basic levels growing and unfolding, but the self has to actually negotiate them, has to actually climb the developmental rungs of expanding awareness, and the self can take a bad step at any rung and get very badly hurt.
So you refer to each of these steps on the ladder of development as a fulcrum.
Yes, based on the very important line of research by such theorists and clinicians as Margaret Mahler, Otto Kernberg, Heinz Kohut, and Gertrude Blanc and Robert Blanc, not to mention Jung's pioneering work on individuation. A fulcrum simply describes the momentous process of differentiation and integration as it occurs in human growth and development. One of Yogi Berra's malapropisms was, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." Well, a fulcrum is simply a crucial fork in the developmental road, and the self has to deal with that fork. How it does so, in each case, influences its subsequent fate.
So nine basic levels of development mean that there are also nine corresponding fulcrums, or steps, for the self to navigate?
That's right. But it's really a very flowing and fluid affair. These milestones are just general markers along the way. The self must step up to each rung in the basic ladder, and that step is the fulcrum at that stage. So every fulcrum has a 1-2-3 structure. 1, the self evolves or develops or steps up to the new level of awareness, and it identifies with that level. It is one with that level. 2, it then begins to move beyond that level or differentiate from it or disidentify with it or transcend it. And 3, it identifies with the new and higher level and centers itself there. The new rung is actually resting on the previous rung, so they must be included and integrated in the overall expansion. And that integration or inclusion is the third and final subphase of the particular fulcrum. So you can remember a fulcrum because all of them have this same 1-2-3 structure. Identify, disidentify, integrate, or fusion, differentiation, integration, or embed, transcend, include. And if anything goes wrong with this 1-2-3 process at any rung, then you get a broken leg or whatnot. And the scar tissue of that disaster will depend on what the world looked like when you broke your leg. And generally, the lower the rung, the more severe the pathology.
So we have the ladder of development and its basic rungs, and we have the self, or the climber, and its respective fulcrums. And that leaves the different views.
Yes, at each rung in the developmental unfolding, there's a different view of the world, a different view of self and of others, a different world view. The world looks different, is different, at each rung in the developmental unfolding. As we've constantly seen, different world spaces, different worlds, come into being as consciousness evolves. There's not simply a pre-given world that's merely reflected. And here I'd particularly emphasize that at each rung, you get a different type of self-identity, a different type of self-need, and a different type of moral stance. All of these are aspects of the different worlds that unfold at each rung or level or sphere of awareness. So that's the thumbnail sketch. The ladder with its basic rungs of awareness, the climber with its fulcrums, and the different views of the world from each rung. Ladder, climber, view.
Now, about these changing views, they also were generally stage-like?
Well, yes, but in a very general sense, which again has confused many critics. All developmentalists, with virtually no exceptions, have a stage-like list, or even a ladder-like list, a holarchy of growth and development. They have this ladder-like holarchy because that's what fits their data. These stages are the results of empirical, phenomenological, and interpretive evidence and massive amounts of research data. These folks are not making this stuff up because they like ladders. But there's an important point about these holarchies. Even in their stronger versions, the self at any given point in its development will tend to give around 50% of its responses from one level, 25% from the level above that, and 25% from the level below it. No self is ever simply at a stage. And further, there are all sorts of regressions, spirals, temporary leaps forward, peak experiences, and so on.
So it's more of a theoretical average.
Well, yes, it's a little bit like what we were saying about cultures. They have an average center of gravity, with some of their members falling above and some below that center. In the same way, the self-system has its own center of gravity, so to speak, which means some components of its own interior can be above, some below, its own average awareness.
You said the self could get hurt at any rung, lose an arm or a leg.
Mm-hmm. Some aspects of the climber can get stuck at lower rungs, and these little aspects get split off from the main climber and remain stuck at those lower stages.
And that's repression.
In the most general sense, yes. The lower and earlier stages of moral development are egocentric, narcissistic, me-only oriented. They tend to be very impulsive and very hedonistic. These are Kohlberg's pre-conventional stages. The middle stages are called conventional because, as we just saw, they tend to be very conformist, my country, right or wrong. The higher stages are called post-conventional because they begin to transcend conventional or conformist modes and center instead on universal pluralism and individual rights. Higher than this are the post-post-conventional or spiritual stages, which we'll get to in a moment. Now, if for various reasons there's some sort of repeated and severe trauma during the earlier stages, say in the pre-conventional stages during the first 3 or 4 years of life, then here's what tends to happen. Since the center of gravity of the self is at this pre-conventional impulsive stage, then aspects of that impulsive self can be split off or dissociated. If this dissociation is extremely severe, then self-development will come to a screeching halt. But more often than not, the self will simply limp along down the road, dissociation and all. It will continue to develop. It will continue to climb the basic runs in expanding awareness, however haltingly or however wounded. It might bleed all over the place, but it keeps climbing. But an aspect of this impulsive self has nonetheless been split off and dissociated. That split off aspect does not continue the climb, does not continue to grow and develop. Rather, it sets up shop in the basement. And it has a moral worldview of stage one, since in this example, that's where the dissociation occurred. It remains at moral stage one, even as the rest of the self continues to grow and develop. So this split-off aspect is completely narcissistic, egocentric, self-absorbed, and altogether impulsive. It continues to interpret the world within the categories available to it at that primitive or archaic stage. As the central organizing self goes on up the ladder, this little aspect of the self remains behind, sabotaging the main self with neurotic or even psychotic symptoms. The main self is getting a higher and wider view of the world, but the little split-off aspect of self is committed to its narcissistic, archaic worldview, its pre-conventional impulses and needs. And the internal conflict between the main self, which now might be at moral stage 3 or 4 or 5, well, the internal conflict between the main self and the little split self of stage 1 can be devastating. This is not an external conflict. It's a civil war. And that, by any other name, is pathology. And as we'll see, one of the things we want to do in development is to help end these civil wars.
But does this mean that a person has to negotiate all the lower levels of development before the deeper or higher or spiritual stages of development can unfold?
Not at all. Individuals can have a spiritual experience, a peak experience, or an altered state of consciousness at almost any stage of their growth. The basic levels, from the lowest to the highest, are potentials in every person's being. So you can tap into the higher dimensions under various conditions, moments of elation, of sexual passion, of stress, of dreamlike reverie, of drug-induced states, and even during psychotic breaks. But look what happens. Say a person has an experience, an influx of certain subtle realm phenomena, perhaps an intense interior illumination. This can profoundly change a person's life and open them to new worlds, new dimensions, new modes of awareness. And perhaps it can lead to an actual transformation or evolution or development in their consciousness. The genuinely spiritual or transpersonal stages of development depend for their development upon all of the previous developments in prior stages and so on. Each of those stages contributes something absolutely essential for the manifestation of the deeper or higher stage. And although a person can have a peak experience of a higher dimension, the person's self still has to grow and develop and evolve in order to permanently accommodate to those higher or deeper dimensions, in order to turn an altered state into a permanent trait.
You have a quote from Aurobindo referencing this phenomena that I'd like to read. "The spiritual evolution obeys the logic of a successive unfolding. It can take a new decisive main step only when the previous main step has been sufficiently conquered. Even if certain minor stages can be swallowed up or leaped over by a rapid and brusque ascension, the consciousness has to turn back to assure itself that the ground passed over is securely annexed to the new condition. A greater or concentrated speed does not eliminate the steps themselves or the necessity of their successive surmounting."
Right. Here Aurobindo describes what I call the difference between states and traits. One of the great problems with the field of transpersonal psychology was that, in its beginning, it tended to focus on peak experiences. You had the ego, which was very bad, and you had anything that was not the ego, which was very good. In fact, the view is often that anything that is not the ego is God. And so you got this type of one-step transformational model. You go from the divisive and analytical and rational and nasty ego straight to the expansive and liberated and cosmic God consciousness. Get rid of ego, you have God. But alas, it is nowhere near that simple. We don't go from an acorn to a forest in a quantum leap. There are stages in all growth, including human. These basic stages, I've listed 9 of them, but that's just a summary, are based on a great deal of empirical, phenomenological, contemplative, and cross-cultural evidence. We're still refining these stages, and there are many questions that need to be answered, but this one-step transformational model now seems to be quite naive. So people can have spiritual experiences and peak experiences and all sorts of altered states, but they still have to carry those experiences in their own structure. They still have to grow and develop to the point that they can actually accommodate the depth offered by the peak experiences. States still must be converted to traits. You still have to go from acorn to oak if you're going to become one with the forest. So while states are important, stages are even more important. Right, here Aurobindo describes what I call the difference between states and traits.
So in other words, with a peak experience, you get a glimpse of dimensions that you might not be able to hold on to.
Oh, that's right. And there's a related problem, which is actually more bothersome. The latter can develop way ahead of the self's willingness to climb it. Technically, we say cognitive development is necessary, but not sufficient for moral development. This means, for example, and we all know cases like this, that a person can be incredibly advanced intellectually and still be at moral stage one. The latter is much higher than the climber, who remains committed to the lower rungs. It's one thing to tap into a higher level, quite another to actually live there. And the same thing can happen with spiritual experiences. People can temporarily access some very high rungs in the ladder or circle of awareness, but they refuse to actually live from those levels. They won't actually climb up there. Their center of gravity remains quite low. And if they're to live up to their spiritual experiences, then they'll have to grow and develop. They'll have to start the developmental unfolding, the holarchical expansion, the actual inhabiting of the expanding spheres of consciousness. Their center of gravity has to shift, to transform to these deeper or higher spheres of consciousness. It does no good to merely idealize them in theoretical chit-chat and talking religion. So you can have a very powerful peak experience, or a satori, but then days, weeks, months later, where do you carry it? What happens to this experience? Where does it reside? Your actual self, your center of gravity, can only accommodate this experience according to its own structure, its own capacity, its own stage of growth. Spiritual experiences do not allow you to simply bypass the growth and development upon which enduring spiritual realization itself depends. Evolution can be accelerated, as Aurobindo said, but not fundamentally skipped over. And if transpersonal growth is engaged with great intensity, then at some point you will climb not just up the ladder, but off it. As Zen would say, you're at the top of a 100-foot pole, and yet you must take one more step. How do you step off a 100-foot pole? You take that step, and where are you? When you step off the ladder altogether, you're in free fall in emptiness. Inside and outside, subject and object, lose all ultimate meaning. You are no longer in here looking at the world out there. You're not looking at the cosmos, you are the cosmos. The universe of one taste announces itself, bright and obvious, radiant and clear, with nothing outside, nothing inside, an unending gesture of great perfection spontaneously accomplished. The very divine sparkles in every sight and sound, and you are simply that. The sun shines not on you, but within you, and galaxies are born and die all within your heart. Time and space dance as shimmering images on the face of radiant emptiness, and the entire universe loses its weight. You can swallow the Milky Way in a single gulp and put Gaia in the palm of your hand and bless it, and it is all the most ordinary thing in the world, and so you think nothing of it.
This concludes Side A.